You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
We have a fun series we get to start today with Dr. Bierman. I am excited to talk about his new book from Concordia Publishing House. We'll do that in just a moment. Today's episode of The Coffee Hour is underwritten in part by Concordia University, Nebraska. You can learn more about Concordia University, Nebraska at cune.edu. Joining us in studio, the Reverend Dr. Joel Bierman, professor of theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis and author of Day 7 for Work, Rest, or Play from Concordia Publishing House. Dr. Bierman, welcome back to the Coffee Hour.
Good to be here again.
It's been a while since we've chatted, and I'm excited because we've locked in for a series on your new book, Day 7.
What a gift. This is going to be fun for me as well.
Oh, good. I'm glad because I was thinking it was going to be fun for us, but I'm glad it'll be fun for you too.
I mean, it will be fun for us.
So, Day 7, that's a good hint at what this is about for work, rest, or play. So why did you choose to write this book about Sabbath?
Yeah, this was a book that I had cooking in my head for a long time. And I'd been thinking about it. And I would tell people, you always get asked at the seminary, what are you working on? And I'd say, oh, I'm thinking about a book on Sabbath. And I get this reaction like, what? Or you get the kind of, usually not said, it's just the facial expression, like, what do you want to do that for? What on earth? Sabbath? You got to be kidding me. You know, it's like ultimate boring. And even people, you know, lay people, they're just like, Sabbath, like whatever. And they're just not interested. But I was convinced there was something here and I was committed to this. And so then I would talk about it from time to time with when I was doing conferences or whatever, I'd maybe hint at some things I was working on. I was getting some feedback, people kind of getting interested in it. So I started telling people, I'm writing a book. So that meant I had to write the book. And so I finally cranked it out and got it done. And it went to publication last summer. So I'm glad it's out.
And finally. Here we are.
Yeah, here we are.
All right,
and somebody's actually read it, which makes me even happier.
Two of us have actually read it.
That's awesome.
I'm into the third chapter.
All right. That's fair.
So, all right.
Okay. It's good stuff.
But I'll catch up.
Yeah, that's good.
Don't worry. We've got 7 episodes.
That's right.
Let's clear up a little bit of phrasing before we jump into Sabbath, because Sabbath and Sabaoth are very similar.
Yeah.
And I am one of those people that was like, oh, it's just a variation of Sabbath, but it's not, is it?
It's not. I actually put one of my few footnotes in there about that.
Sarah reads the footnotes, by the way.
I read the footnotes.
That's good. I tell my students all the time, footnotes are part of the reading. You have to read them.
That's true.
And so, anyway, I'm glad you're reading them. But yes, this is one of those things that shows up liturgically where you have Yahweh Sabaoth. And, you know, you think, well, that's just a weird spelling of Sabbath. Sabbath Yahweh, you know, God of Sabbath or something. But Sabaoth in Hebrew means Lord of hosts, of armies. And so Yahweh Sabaoth is the Lord of armies. And Sabbath means something entirely different. Sabbath comes from a root which means to stop doing something, to cease. And so they're completely different, totally unrelated.
And this book is about Sabbath, not Sabbath.
Armies.
That's right, not about armies.
Armies is a different episode at some point.
That could come time.
That'd be a fun series.
It's another book for you to write.
I'm interested in that as well. Yeah.
Of course. Okay, so what is and what is not this book? Is this like another self-help book or is this something entirely different?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of self-help books, but I also wrote this book with somewhat of a deliberate intention because I wanted this to be able to be read by people in the church. And I always think I'm writing for that kind of target, but I don't always succeed. In fact, my critic on this is my father. And so all the books I've written, I've given to him when they're in manuscript form and say, here, take a look at this, because he's looking for something to read. So he reads through them. And I'll say, I was writing this for people to, you know, lay people to read. What do you think? And my first couple of books, no, you didn't succeed.
This is common.
Like, no, you didn't do it. You know, it's written at a level that's not going to, you know, your vocabulary or whatever. So, okay. So I really wanted this one to be that. So I was trying to figure out, you know, how to approach that. So I tried. And so my goal is not to make this too academic or, you know, too far removed, but something that people can read and say, I get it. I know what you're talking about. And so it's not to be a self-help book, but it is something that's, I think, there to make a profound impact on people's real lives. I'm not just trying to dump information about something obscure in theology or some kind of historical thing you should be interested in. But my hope is that people will read this and say, wow, that makes a difference in how I look at my life right now. That's my goal.
Okay, so in the introduction, you reference Aristotle and his four causes.
Yeah.
Help us understand this. Because that's going to be critical for where we go from here, right?
It is. It's an important first kind of move. And this is one of those things where I'm writing for an audience that I want everybody to be able to read this, but I also don't want to treat people like they're dumb. You know, mm-hmm. people are eager to learn. And one of the things I have learned teaching in the church for decades now is that we sell our people short most of the time. We expect way too little of them. And when you start giving them information, they're just ready, give me more, give me more. And so I just want to lay it all out there. So I think Aristotle's four causes are a really useful way of approaching anything for understanding. And causes is always a little misleading. He's really getting at more of the sources of things or how things happen, what makes things tick, what makes them what they are. And so his four causes are the material cause, the efficient cause, the formal cause, and the final cause. And the material cause is what something literally is made out of. The efficient cause is how that thing came to be. Then the final cause and the formal cause are very interesting. The final cause is a little easier to get. That's what's it made for? What's the goal? Formal cause is the most difficult for us to grasp because that's the idea that there's a plan that's shaping how this thing came to be. So you can think about a statue. A statue is made out of marble. Its efficient cause is the sculptor who makes it. The formal cause would be the mind, the plan that the sculptor has in his head. This is going to be this. And so that's what forms him as he does the carving. But then the final cause is there's the statue. Or maybe the final cause is someone looks at it and says, beauty. And so now you get into the real telos or the goal of the thing. And telos is just the Greek word for goal and target. The final cause is the telos.
So how does that help us understand Sabbath?
Well, Sabbath is all about the point of what it means to be human. That's kind of my argument. And one of the things I'm getting into in the book, and I'm sure you guys are interested in talking about this, we'll get there eventually.
Yes, we will.
It's kind of the first chapter, is how Sabbath gets misunderstood. But my whole point is when you get Sabbath right, it has extraordinary significance for what it means to be human, what you're here for, and basically the purpose of life. That's why it's a big deal.
So let's unpack that a little bit more about, because you said you mentioned writing a book about Sabbath to people and you get like the blank stare.
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, that's nice.
It's like,
good for you.
Exactly.
Exactly. You know, they're very tolerant, kind of, you know, whatever. Silly some for us. Okay. Yes.
So why is it important for us to consider something that might consideration sounds a bit boring. Why is it important for us to actually take some time to slow down and think about this?
Yeah, and the reason is because of what Sabbath actually means biblically and what's actually going on. And that was kind of my big surprise is as I dug into this more and got more, because I was just curious, and we'll get to that in a minute, kind of my initial curiosity. But the deeper I got into this, the more I realized there's a ton going on here. And then you start seeing all these kind of disparate pieces sort of kind of coming together and you think, all right, there's some continuity here. This is resonating with the way things are and the way that God put things together. So, and I think Sabbath is that way. It's not just one of the Ten Commandments that we don't know what to do with, but it's actually core to God's plan for creation and what it means to be human. Big deal. So I'm going to try to sell you on that.
And I love it.
I want to talk more about what Sabbath is and the many misunderstandings of Sabbath.
Yeah.
But before we do that,
yeah,
I want one more point of clarification because good, it's going to be necessary. It like shapes the direction for, sets the direction for the rest of the conversation.
Yeah.
And this is the relationship between person and purpose, or the word you use, telos.
Yeah.
What's the relationship between person and purpose? Who determines a person's purpose or telos?
And this gets back to the four causes, and this is why it's important. So we think about the four causes applied to a human being. So we're made out of, you know, carbon, water, a little silica, whatever. You know, the scientists will tell you what you're made out of, literally. And in the efficient cause, we can talk about, well, you know, that's the birds and the bees, you know, okay, it all happens. So that we can cover that. And scientists are usually pretty good at telling us about the material and the efficient causes about things. They're not so great about the formal cause and they're clueless when it comes to final causes. But if you're going to know what something's for, you got to know what it's for. And the final cause is important. So when it comes to human beings, the person, what he is, what he's made out of, okay, we can figure that out. But his purpose, what's it all about? That is kind of a big mystery. And especially if you're a hardcore materialist, but all you have is the stuff you see, you don't have a clue what something's for, what its purpose is, you know, to reproduce.
There you go.
But that's... why? Why bother? You know, and as a human,
how Darwinian.
Yeah, exactly. And when you're a human being with some rational capacity, immediately that doesn't seem nearly to cut it. That's great for animals, but it doesn't cut it for human beings. And so the purpose for human beings becomes critical because what you're here for, what it means to be human, what you're supposed to accomplish, what your human purpose becomes critical to the very understanding of self-identity, who I am, mm-hmm. you know, what I'm supposed to be doing. And so they're very closely tied together. Aristotle knew that, and he was right about that.
So who is it then that determines that?
Well, that's the big question. And when you have a culture like ours, when God has been essentially eradicated from real life, you know, he's there if you need him. He's there if you find that interesting. But he has no critical role to play in people's lives. People are left now to figure out their own answers to those questions, which creates the crisis of modernity and the crisis mm-hmm. of postmodernity, where you have what we often call nihilism, where there's absolutely nothing you can be sure of. There is nothing more than what you see. And in that kind of world, meaning is hard to find.
There's no objective truth.
And this becomes crucial in the problem of human identity, because if there is no objective truth and there's nothing more than me or what I see, then whose job is it to figure out my purpose? Well, it devolves to me. And that's an incredible burden to bear. And it's a burden that when people pay attention to it, start thinking about it, it can become debilitating. And this is a crisis I think we see in a lot of young people. And there are things like hardcore sad realities like suicide rates and depression rates that are anxiety, all tied to this. And it's not accidental. These things are all happening at the same time. But that's a whole other topic.
Yes.
That's our next series.
That's... All right, we will continue the conversation in just a moment. We're going to talk more about Sabbath in the Catechism in just a moment with Dr. Bierman as we're taking a look at Day 7 for Work, Rest, or Play from Concordia Publishing House. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
At Concordia University, Nebraska, discover a distinctly Christian community that equips students to live by faith with courage, character, and conviction. Intentionally combining our Christian faith, Lutheran heritage, rigorous academics, and practical real-life experiences, we prepare students to fulfill a higher purpose in their vocations and life. Learn more about Concordia University, Nebraska at our website, cune.edu. That's cune.edu.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Joel Bierman about his book, Day 7 for Work, Rest, or Play from Concordia Publishing House. And we laid some groundwork already, and now we're going to jump into a little bit of different groundwork in the Catechism.
Okay.
Because if we're talking Sabbath, we got to talk about the third commandment. And let's go way back to the Reformation era.
Yeah.
What was Luther's context in writing the explanation to the third commandment?
Yeah, well, this gets interesting. So we have the small catechism most of us are familiar with. You know, we grew up learning it as a kid. We say it in church and stuff. We're familiar with it. And so we got the third commandment on the Sabbath is part of what we memorize. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. What does this mean? Fear and love God. So we hear God's word, honor it, learn it, study it, you know, and that kind of thing. And so it all kind of hangs together. So the third commandment for Luther was part of his project of providing pedagogical tool for parishes in the dearth of their understanding of the Bible or basic Christian reality. So he came around to saying, I need to provide some material. People don't know stuff. So he wrote the small catechism as an effort to provide basic training. And he saw the Ten Commandments as a critical place to start because it lays out God's will for creation, the law. And so the third commandment was interesting because he's operating now in a situation where the wider Reformation is kind of going full tilt. And we're going to get into the, you know, Karlstadt and all this kind of historical minutiae, which gets, you know, interesting if you're a historian.
We
but
love
the bottom
history.
Line.
I thought it was pretty interesting.
Oh,
I did
glad
too,
you enjoyed that.
We okay. love history here.
Okay, good. I'll dabble in it, but all the historians will tell me I'm not one, and I will readily admit that.
I mean, it did take me back to that scene in the 2000, what year was that film? The Luther movie.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Do you remember that scene with Karlstadt and like burning books? And
oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah, that's exciting stuff. So anyway, Luther was not the only reformer. One of his colleagues, Karlstadt, who was actually working in Wittenberg with Luther when Luther was secreted off to the Wartburg Castle after the Worms thing and in hiding for the whole winter of 20 to 21, Karlstadt was running the Reformation. And Karlstadt decided Luther's not going far enough, fast enough, so Karlstadt kind of went bonkers. And did all kinds of crazy stuff. He celebrated Christmas Eve Mass by, or Christmas Day Mass by wearing just street clothes, which was scandalous.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he did communion with both kinds, and nobody was ready for that. And it's like blowing people away. He married a 15-year-old girl, and he got married. And then he also cleared out the imagery from the castle church, or from the church where he was preaching. So all this in a busy winter. He was doing a lot. Winter, Luther heard about this, was troubled by this. So he went back, came back to Wittenberg, and basically said, Karlstadt, no, you're wrong. We're not doing this. You're going way too fast. You know, back it off. Some of the things he agreed with, but it's all about timing and what's right. So anyway, Luther backed off of that. Karlstadt doubled down and became known as what we call a Sabbatarian. He was one of these guys who believed we have to keep all the Old Testament law exactly the way it is, or we're not being a good Christian. That was what he was committed to. Luther wanted nothing to do with that because he thought we're going from Roman Catholic legalism now into a new Reformed legalism. What's with that? What are you doing on, you know, Karlstadt? So he had zero use for this, and he wanted to give absolutely no credence to Karlstadt. So when he comes to the third commandment, here it is, the Sabbath command. And this is the very thing that Karlstadt's leaning into. You know, what do you do for Sabbath? No work. You stay at home. You do nothing but sit and think about what a horrible sinner you are and what God's grace means for you. And it was Karlstadt describes it. It was a sober, austere, nasty day. I don't know if you read the Little House books when you were a kid.
Oh, yeah.
And remember what Laura's attitude was to Sundays? She hated Sundays because her pa, who was a little bit of a puritanical kind of guy, would make she and her sister just sit and they could read their Bible. That's all I could do. Had to sit, and that was it. So he was like perfectly channeling the Karlstadt way of life. And Luther wanted nothing to do with it. So when Luther wrote his small catechism, I'm convinced, he basically said, I'm not going anywhere near any of that stuff, which is why the small catechism, the third commandment, is kind of weird. And this is the thing that really, frankly, got me started on this whole book, was a eighth grade memory I had of learning catechism, going to catechism class, my dad teaching, and thinking, wow, third commandment's weird. You know, because all these other commandments demand us to do all this stuff. And Luther takes like the fifth commandment, don't kill. Eighth grade kid thinks, not killing, that's easy. I've not killed anybody. There's a gimme. Then you read Luther. Well, you can't hurt anybody. You can't say nasty things about them. Oh, man, I'm in trouble. Not only this, but you have to help people and go out of your way. It's like, holy smokes. So Luther takes the commandment and just explodes it. And does it with all of them. The third commandment, he does the opposite. Remember the Sabbath day. Okay, what do I need? Can't work. What do I need to do? Go to church, pay attention. Oh, cool. Got it. And you're done. And that's the third commandment. Go to church, pay attention, because that's what it boils down to. Hear God's word. Well, maybe you can read your Bible once in a while, but go to church, listen to the sermon, and pay attention. You're good. And it's so weird because he inverses everything. But I'm convinced part of the reason was he didn't want to give Karlstadt any more room or any wiggle room. And that was a big issue. So there's a long answer to a good question.
Avoiding works righteousness from any form of Sabbatarianism imaginable.
Yeah. Exactly. And this is the whole point. The works righteousness, the legalism of I'm going to work my way. No, Luther wanted nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how does this, so we've got Luther and we've got Karlstadt. What were some other views regarding the commandment regarding the Sabbath from other confessions or traditions?
Yeah. Now, see, one of the critical thing here is there's people have often wrestled with this. So what do you do with this third commandment? What do you do with how do you keep the Sabbath? And we know that there are some traditions, and they're still around today. It's not just Luther's time. You know, you got the Dutch Reformed, you know, who are hardcore about this kind of stuff. Can't hang out your clothes on a Sunday afternoon. Can't mow the lawn. Shouldn't, you know, you can't even watch TV if you're really being a good Dutch Reformed. And this is in the Southwest Michigan. I have so much familiar.
Oh, yeah. Familiar with that.
And so you get that. But see, the bigger issue really is just how we understand our relationship with the law. And the kind of shocking thing, even to a lot of Lutherans, is to realize that Luther's attitude was Old Testament law, done. All of it's gone. All of it has all been fulfilled in Christ. And this is like the shocker, because you want to think, well, no, you got to keep some parts. No, it's just all gone. Then why should you come back to the Ten Commandments? Well, because the Ten Commandments are an expression of God's natural law, the wired in order, structure, design that God has for the entire world. And that holds. The details for Israel, that's just Israel's rules. The law of God for all of creation, that's what we need to pay attention to. And what Luther's doing with the third commandment, he's pulling out what he would say is the natural law rule for all people that still applies even for New Testament believers.
So this understanding of the third commandment as go to church and pay attention, which is also what I thought it was when I was in eighth grade catechism. Is this an incomplete understanding of the third commandment?
Yes, it's incomplete. It's not wrong. Luther's not wrong. I want to be clear on this.
I'm not arguing with Luther today.
I make that point in the book more than once. I'm not arguing with Luther. So it's not wrong, but there's more going on. And my point is, I think Luther backed off of some of the more because he didn't want to give Karlstadt any more room. And he didn't want to give the Sabbatarians any kind of leg to stand on. But Luther's right to boil things down to, this is a matter of being in tune with God. Because that's really what hearing God's word comes down to, is being in tune with God. And that, I'm going to contend, is really the core of what Sabbath is about.
Okay, so then what is this, the fundamental principle? This is why we talked about it, for understanding the third commandment and Sabbath.
Yeah, so the fundamental thing for understanding the third commandment and Sabbath is to be in tune with God. And this is where the title of my book comes in, Day 7. Because what does God do on Day 7? He stops creating, he rests. And why? And we'll talk more about that. But God rests on the seventh day, and then we have the Old Testament picking up on, because God rested, I want you, my people, to rest. Well, what's with that? And there's all kinds of theories people have about, well, people get tired, they need a rest. I think there's more going on. And my more that I think is going on is what Luther picks up on. No, the real point is, I want you to live in tune with me. I want you to be my creatures who know their creator, who spend time with me, and who he learned from me, and who interact with me. That's what Sabbath is really all about.
Let's talk more about that rhythm that comes from creation and the day that God rests.
Yeah, this is one of the really cool things, I think, about the creation account is, you know, we have all the speculation about why God did what he did, and, you know, why did he create in 6 days? Augustine even said, I didn't need 6 days. He just could have done it in an instant. Course. But he does it in 6 days. And that's the account we have. And so why? And I think the best understanding of this is because God is establishing ways for the world to work. He's establishing rhythms. He's teaching us about the world, about ourselves, about our place in the world. And the very rhythm of the week captures this. And so you have a evening and a morning. That's how the Hebrew numbers it. The day starts with the evening, and the next day we get up and do our work for that day. And then we begin with another day with resting and sleeping. We'll talk more about that later on. But the rhythm then is there that we are working for 6 days, and then we have this day when we just stop and we can celebrate and delight. And that's really what God's doing on day 7. He's just sort of delighting in his creation and celebrating. And that's what we do as well. That's part of this rhythm. And that becomes core to our very human being.
Delight. I hope we get to use that word more.
It's one of my core values.
It's been a while since we really used that word. Emotions in the gospel. We talked with Heidi Gaiman on that. That was fun to get to dig into that topic.
Oh, good.
Our time is up for today, but we have more in this series, so fear not. We'll talk more with Dr. Freeman coming up next week. We'll continue the conversation as we take a look at the second chapter in Day 7 for Work, Rest, or Play from Dr. Joel Bierman and Concordia Publishing House. You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.